This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence.
Welcome back to The Human and Machine, the podcast series which looks at the digital world from the ground up, not machine down. If you're new to this series, hello. I'm Julia Hobsbawm.
And I'm Charles Arthur. Today we're looking at a very hot topic, perhaps the hot topic concerning the internet and social media, which is race and racism online and offline.
Clearly people do racist things on the internet. Clearly people traffic in that kind of value system and so forth online. But the question I was interested in was something more like, is the internet racist? And if so, how do we make that kind of determination? What do we look at? How do we sort of have some kind of criteria to define it? So those were the questions that motivated me when I first started to look in this area. And it was questions that I saw no one really addressing or answering in that way.
That's the American academic and expert on race and the internet, Professor Charlton McIlwain of New York University's Center for Critical Race and Digital Studies. As Charles said, this episode is devoted to the question of race in society and online. It is 5 years since the hashtag Black Lives Matter first appeared, and a period which has seen an explosion both in racism against all ethnicities online, but also of activism. In a moment, we'll be joined in the studio by two writers and commentators who are, in addition to many other ways to describe their skills and heritage, people of color and commentators, in part, about race. Yasmin Alibi Brown and Rowan Kandapa. But to set the scene, I went to New York to talk to Charlton McIlwain on the eve of the publication of his new book, Black Software, The Internet and Racial Justice, From the AfroNet to Black Lives Matter.
Black Software really goes back and tries to understand the historical relationship of race and African Americans to computing technology. And the argument I really look to make is to say, here is the structure in which all of our computing technologies have emerged, from the personal computer to the internet, and that they have emerged in a structural system of racism and discrimination that tinges and also helps to limit and foreclose on certain possibilities on which that technology can be used.
So this is a far deeper dive into looking at racism on the internet and people trolling each other and being vicious, right? This is structural inequality around race that you're saying is embedded in the computational technology.
It is structural, and it's easy to get caught up these days in saying, you know, here's racism there, here online, or with a particular failing of a company. And really what I try to do is to go beyond that and try to show the ways in which our technologies have been embedded within a system and structure of racism and discrimination from the beginning that really touches and looks past sort of individuals and looks at the system that is really at fault and structuring the ways in which we use technologies and structuring the sort of the limits and possibilities that they hold out for us.
So you're writing about the politics of race as it appears in the digital era. Who is fighting the fight? You know, in American political history, you have a rich tradition of civil rights, and most recently you had Jesse Jackson. Who's the Jesse Jackson, or who is the Martin Luther King of this space? Who's fighting for change outside of academia, people such as yourselves?
I would say there are many people out there, and I think the one thing that is different about our present moment and the digital arena is that there isn't one sort of leader. I think there are many who are with a voice that is a collective voice, saying we can talk about individual technologies, we can talk about AI, we can talk about the internet, we can talk about digital media or Twitter or Facebook or varying platforms, but all of that is really an aside unless we address critical foundational questions about the system and structure of racism and white supremacy in the U.S. and around the world, because that is really the larger framework that shapes the context for our technology.
So presumably there's a bit of a read across, or quite a lot of a read across, with, say, Black Lives Matter, which has not only used the internet as it happens, but is a very active force and is, as you say, more of a distributed network rather than key individuals. Does that give you cause for optimism, or do you still feel that there's something, is there something missing in the movement for change?
I think there is something missing, and I think there is a disconnect, and that the disconnect is between the folks that say, look, yeah, maybe we have problems, and maybe even our problems are around ethics and race and so forth, but the problem is with our machines. So if we can just make our machine learning algorithms work better, if we can just make them more fair or more just or less biased, then we've won the race and we've won the award. And so the disconnect is between that and folks who over and over again say, beyond our technology, we have a problem with race and racism that fundamentally must be addressed if we ever hope to address the problems within our technology. And I think these are largely two separate groups of people who rarely come in contact with each other and who frequently simply talk past or certainly don't understand where each is coming from.
That is the American academic and expert on race and the internet, Professor Charlton McIlwain of New York University's Center for Critical Race and Digital Studies.
We'll hear more from Charlton later on, but this is a fascinating subject which seems, as so often happens in the internet era, to suddenly surface as a buzz topic. Here in Britain, there's been not only an upsurge in anti-Semitism associated with, of all things, the Labour Party, but more recently, the BBC sacked its longtime radio presenter, Danny Baker, for posting a very offensive image with clear racist connotations following the birth of the new royal baby who has African-American heritage. Here to discuss the issue of race and racism online and in the offline is Yasmin Alibi Brown and Rowan Kandapa. Yasmin is a Ugandan Asian British citizen who's an award-winning journalist and commentator on social and racial issues. Rowan is an advertiser turned commentator and comic performer who uses his own experience as a second-generation British-born immigrant of Sri Lankan descent to inform his routines. Yasmin, let's start by asking you this question. How serious, how widespread is the problem of race and racism on the internet?
I think it's, I'm not saying anything new here. The internet has been two totally opposite forces, a force for good, a true democratization of people who never had a voice before, and Black Lives Matter is one of those, because the media, as we know, is controlled, access is denied. It takes a lot to open the doors to those who don't belong to this kind of strangely inward-looking world of the British media and probably the American media too. So in a sense, that explosion of freedom is how the inventors used to talk about the internet as a liberation, democratic space. But of course, it didn't take long for people to realize that that could also be one of the most intimidating, silencing, atrociously racist places too.
How could it be silencing? I mean, well, you know, in a place where everyone
there are days, there are weeks when things are so bad that I do two things. I have to have the police in, and the police say, don't tweet for a couple of weeks.
So silencing because you're actually in danger of using your voice.
Or the fear takes over. You know, the fear becomes a way of saying, do I really want to do this?
Because what? Because you're getting threatening messages?
And some of them are threatening, and that's where the police come in. But it is overwhelming. The denial, the anger, the crude hatred, if you talk about racism in Britain.
But presumably it's if you talk about other things as well, because women, yep, as well as people of colour, experience, yep, a huge amount of opprobrium and attack online. And of course, you're both. You're a woman of colour.
Yeah, but it just has become the norm. And people say to you, live with it? Why would you want to live with it? If I went to a pub and somebody did this to me, yeah, I wouldn't be told, live with it. It is quite frightening. So I am torn. I love the internet. I'm very frightened of it.
I mean, there's an interesting thing in what Professor McIlwain has said. There's a paper that he's written online as well, where he talks about, because he has this phrase in that clip about the internet is racist, which I thought, how do you get there. But it's interesting that in the paper he says that analysing network traffic, you look at the traffic and you get a lot of traffic between sites which are not specifically about one group or another. And then you get, you know, a lot of traffic which does diverge to, you know, specific groups. And so that you get this sort of segmentation. I don't know, Rowan, whether you see the same sort of thing happening, but I sort of started to understand what he meant in as much as he seems to be suggesting that the internet can segment. And I've always thought that the internet is sort of about joining small niche groups together, and that effectively what we're sort of seeing is a filtration, a sort of a separation via the internet.
Segregation,
possibly.
Well, it does create sort of silos of thinking where you can just communicate with people who have the same point of view as you, and that can sort of then turn into a kind of vicious spiral downwards if you are prejudiced, that one person's prejudiced message feeds into another one, and that seems to become a prevailing conversation that you're kind of stuck in. So that does happen, and clearly that's not a good thing. But his statement that the internet is racist, I suppose you'd have to see more evidence to show that, presumably in his book, that he does come to that. But I kind of see the internet more as it enables these things to happen, right? So it can enable the good things to happen, and it can enable the bad things to happen. But if there's no sort of policing of it, and there's no editorial guidance, as you do get with a traditional publication, then anything can happen and anything can get said.
What's interesting about Charlton McIlwain's research is the earlier research that you're referring to, Charles, that took place in 2016, analysed massive volumes of web posts and web links, and seemed to show that it's really the humans, not the machines, that are at fault, that the algorithms and the compilation and sharing of material is not racist, but the humans which select which material to focus on and to share is. And there was a difference there. But equally, he seems to be saying in this new book, Black Software, that there is a structural systemic design which is racist. Yasmin, that's such a big bold claim.
And it's very, really important, because it reminded me of Caroline Credo Perez's book, when she wrote about how so much research into products, into science, into everything, the norm is male. And therefore, actually, women's lives are being endangered. Nobody's sitting there being sexist. But the way this work is done, unquestioned for centuries, has led to a situation where a woman putting on a seatbelt is in more danger. And this work reminds me of it. But what was interesting to me when I read the paper, that in a way you're right, Julia, he says that he seems to imply that this is part of a kind of neocon project, because he says that civil rights and so on were kind of, things were getting a bit better. And this project assumes civil rights ended in the 60s. So they truncated the whole process. And the only thing to worry about is the law. And it almost seemed in his paper that this was a well thought out project in some ways, which I found very interesting. And very, so more of it will be in the book. So you're right, it's the human, not the machine.
But the new norms question, I came across a tweet from an ethical shoe brand today, which said, we would like to recall the name of nude we've given our new shoe, because we now accept that that's racist, because the colour nude has been traditionally, historically used to give a norm of white skin. And part of me's thinking, this is really exciting and innovative, and this is change. This is how change happens. And I've got to say, another part of me thinks, what? This is mad. What is a new norm?
A big debate at the moment, isn't it? Well, what words mean and how you interpret them. And that's what so much of this kind of comes down to.
I'm flushing with guilt, actually, as I even say that, because I don't quite know, and I'm not sure white people do know completely what people of colour are feeling when they say, you are offending me. We're going to talk more about this later on.
Yeah, and it's not mad, because
is it not mad at all?
No, it's not. Okay. For years, I couldn't find foundation for my skin colour, because all foundations were pink. eventually it took, I think, a mixed-race woman in America to say, look, there's a market here. Why aren't you even thinking about the money you could make? Couldn't buy foundation.
Rihanna's Fenty range is very much on that premise that different skin tones need different
And I'm not even very dark brown, but couldn't find something that would not look like I was, you know, wearing a mask. It was awful.
It seems like this gets discovered every generation or so, that sort of, you know, there are people who are not white and who are female and need foundation. I sort of feel that this has been rediscovered many times, and yet the lesson doesn't seem to stick. But, I mean, in terms of the racism question online, the thing that seems strange, I guess, to people who are techno-optimists is, well, no one knows what your race is online. Surely you can just be who you are. Why does it come through? Why does it sort of seep through communication that one uses? Why is it that it becomes an important thing? Shouldn't it be that if we're just communicating in text on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever, that actually it becomes unimportant? Why is it that the segregation is still there rather than it being something which is not important?
Well, I mean, you're right. It should be like, as you were saying, it should be more egalitarian, more equal, but it doesn't work that way in practice.
And why not that?
Because, well, I think there must be lots of reasons, but part of the reason must be because what comes up online is a representation of what's in society.
Yeah.
What's happened online is that things that have been under the surface and not openly acknowledged or could be talked about because they were seen as beyond the pale, that's not using the wrong word in a debate about colour, but I mean, it can be expressed in these forums with no recourse. I mean, I've always thought it was kind of essentially online. You can say things without having any responsibility for what you say. So that enables abuse to occur. And I thought about it in terms of, you know, simpler things in terms of like when my daughter was a teenager, you think, well, she could receive messages without any acknowledgement of where they've come from.
But just wind it back a little. I'd still just like to zero in on this thing of why it is that we can't get past our social identity when we're online. Why it is that somehow these things come out. Is it because we find ourselves expressing the ideas that are sort of, you know, embedded in us from how we grew up, or is it something to do with filter bubbles and how one tends to associate with people who have similar views? I'm still a little, you know, the techno-optimist in me is still a little puzzled, and maybe, Yasmin, you have an idea on
but
this.
But I don't, you know, it's not that much a puzzle. I think what had happened until, I would suggest, the 2005-06 was people understood that whatever you thought, we all have ugly thoughts. Goodness me, we all have ugly thoughts about other people. We are always unfair. We're all capable of prejudice. But in the public space was slowly getting civilized. So it didn't matter to me whether you hated me, but in the public space, you didn't treat me with indignity, with poisonous language.
Is it the public space offline or the public space online?
No, I would include online. But I think what the assumption was, on the bus, on in the internet, you kind of held back your worst prejudices. That has gone. People are emboldened both on the internet and in the public space.
So would you blame what you're saying? Is social networks at fault here?
Partly. It's partly also the political changes that have happened. And he does deal with that in his paper.
Hmm. Let's come back in a minute to social media. But I'd like to broaden the question out more to the internet and to design bias, which is also partly what Professor McIlwain is writing about. So, for example, we absolutely know that quite a lot of AI face recognition is so flawed in its design that it wrongly identifies people with a different skin tone. We know that algorithms around language mean that certain translations automatically give the masculine for an international term like doctor, which ought to be gender neutral. Try having doctor translated into Turkish, and I understand there is no female equivalent. So to some degree, I wonder whether Professor McIlwain isn't really on to something when he talks about a much more systemic design problem that really is disadvantaging different groups. What does anyone think about
that?
Well,
I think he's right. What I liked about his thinking was he's also got a very deep understanding about race politics. and the sort of struggles through how many decades for progress on this. So he locates that very much in the broader history. And I think that's what makes his work very powerful. So he's not just looking at the design, just as the feminists are looking at bias against women. It's part of a broader cultural problem. Unless we see it in that way, we can deal with this, maybe find ways to neutralize AI and the internet. But the broader culture in which it is located is just as important.
Charles, you write a lot about the nitty-gritty of design of hardware and software and the sudden cultural shifts. I mean, you know, try getting Android out of a Huawei set right at this moment in time. But I mean, what are you seeing about these new sensibilities, this awareness around serious design bias?
There's a lot of uncertainty, I guess you would say, among a lot of the tech companies about quite how they should do it better. They've recognized that there are big markets to be found, and you know, where there's money, then they tend to adjust. But I mean, you're talking about companies which are struggling to adjust with the idea that there are women who can do jobs well. So then the idea that there are people who, you know, aren't white who can do the jobs well or better tends to be a bit of an adjustment for them, even though companies like Google, Microsoft, you know, these are led by people of, you know, Indian extraction.
And Google was running workshops, I happen to know, on unconscious bias for its own staff. I mean, at least they were addressing that reality some time ago. But I mean, really what I'm saying is, isn't it the case that we are now waking up to different dimensions that haven't been considered, whether it's in the cosmetic ranges, and that maybe the language is the least of our worries, that it's the fundamental system that is, in fact, shutting people out?
Yeah, I think also you have to look at how these things were built and who builds them, right? And the internet, they're machines. People are people. And I think what we're having is a clash between building machines and figuring out how humans interact with them. And the criteria for success in these companies that build these things, you've got to look at what those are, because I think that's where the biases kind of get built into it. Because, you know, if you're being judged by, I don't know what criteria they use, but are all to do with numbers and figures and
tends to be how many ads has someone looked at.
Yeah, exactly. You know, all that kind of stuff, that doesn't necessarily sit well with the fact it's people who are using it. Right. And I have a sort of limited experience of working in a startup company and seeing that, you know, how they're driven forward. So move fast and break things was this mantra, right? And I looked at that and I thought, well, that just sounds stupid, because where you end up with surely is maybe your company does end up miles ahead of everyone else, but the things that you break could well be people who are lying. And I think this is what's being worked out now. This is what's happening, is that we've gone past the age of sort of like techno-dazzle where everything was wonderful. And now it's like, oh, well, certain things have moved way ahead, but there's a lot of things that have been left behind, and it might be us.
I guess the sort of the alternative translation of the Facebook motto, I mean, it's an old motto now, but is sort of leave a long trail of destruction. But I guess the thing that does happen is that they tend to cater for the larger audience, that, you know, niches, minorities tend to be the afterthought in that sense. You know,
there's also an assumption, a completely unsustainable assumption, that this brave new world was neutral. It was clean. It had none of this baggage. Those were the kind of promised lands we were being taken to. So that needed to change. But the other really important point to make is this kind of work is coming at a time when, certainly in the West, but not only in the West, I would include India, I would include Turkey, and so on, you've got the rise and rise of some very frightening hard right forces. So just as you're getting stuff that we need to be thinking about, we're getting vast populations who are now resisting equality.
Perfect timing, because I want to move the conversation exactly on to fight back and resistance. Less so the Arab Spring, which was billed as the social media revolution, which of course turned out to be a social media moment, but not a life-changing revolution. But in particular regarding race, racism has found a bit of a match online with activism. The writer Afua Hirsch, who writes for The Guardian, 3 million people watched her post of an argument she had on television trying to explain, finding herself forced to explain what racism actually is. What's going on with regard to Fight Back? There is an upside to social media being able to spread hate. It's also spreading resistance, right?
Yeah, but who's strong and who's weak in this? I mean, I have been very shocked by how many people, and I'm really pleased Afua did this, because she's right. The denials come so thick and fast at you.
So the context is that she was invited onto, I think it was a Sky...
discussion. She's a regular
right.
on The Pledge.
And they were discussing the tweet that Danny Baker put out, which was after the birth of Meghan Markle, Prince Harry's baby. He put out a picture of a chimp between two couples and in a tweet, and people jumped on and said, "Danny, that is incredibly racist." And he sort of was puzzled for a bit and then deleted it and then apologised and then got very defensive, was fired by the BBC. The day after, I think, issued a long apologia. But yes, Afua was invited onto the TV programme to defend or to make the case about it being racist and the extent to which one should act over this.
It's not Danny Baker's fault.
That's not Danny Baker's fault. But what is Danny Baker's fault is that he did something which was so offensive that when I first saw it, I actually thought it was a prank. I just thought nobody who the BBC gives a platform could be stupid enough to say this and not intend it to be racist, because it is one of, and we could talk about unintended racism or microaggressions. This is none of those. This is the most blatant, clear-cut example of racism. It's that generations of people have recognized this as an overtly racist trope.
The denials, just the denials all the time. You say, this is happening, and a wall comes at you of, you're just being politically correct. This is freedom of speech. You know, all this stuff comes at you. And she's absolutely right. The problem is not that we've got to deal with racism and the social media is very good at resisting. But how many times can you carry on in one lifetime showing people what's happening before giving up in exhaustion or having a nervous breakdown?
So is the problem that there's a disparity in numbers, that minorities will always, by definition, be fewer in number, and so in order to make their voice heard against the majority, who may be silent or they may be noisy on Twitter and so on, the minority have to be extra active, which can be just exhausting.
But also, why the denial? I mean, I was on Nick Ferrari, who was one of the people she was with, Farah Hirsch was with, and I said, how can he not know this is racist? Footballers, black footballers have been talking about having bananas thrown at them, being called monkeys for how long now? How can you not know? But secondly, I'm not being holier than thou. I was raised to be racist against black people in East Africa. That's how we were raised. We were taught there were monkeys. I've spent my whole life unlearning that, not denying it. So I said to Ferrari, why can't you, instead of recoiling and then fighting back, just use that moment to think? We all have to unlearn things, actually.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point. I think if the debate and the whole thing is going to move forward, we have to find ways of recognising the prejudice that exists within ourselves. And because I think often when things are just described as racist, then the person you're describing puts up barriers, right? Because it sounds like the worst thing you can say about people often. So they become incredibly defensive and there's no chance of any discourse. But what Yasmin has just said there is really important, because she admitted when she was growing up, I had this prejudice. And I think it's important that we all do that, because that gives us a chance to start a conversation that moves things forward.
In psychology, they talk about optimism bias. And I first learned about optimism bias when I went on a traffic awareness course, which you get sent on if you drive too fast. And instead of revoking your license or fining you, you go and sit in a room with 50 other people on a Saturday morning to mend your ways. And everybody sits there resistant. And everybody sits there with arms folded saying, well, it was just a blip what happened to me because I'm a safe driver. The instructor convinced certainly me, and I think a lot of others on the course that morning, that our actions were dangerous, that we actually did know deep down they were dangerous, that we got caught as a one-off, but that what we were doing was very purposefully doing something bad, naughty, dangerous. And I wonder whether the same optimism bias, the same psychological trope is at work in that. Does Danny Baker, this particular British broadcaster, it could have been any number of broadcasters around the world, he ran off at the mouth, he disconnected his thoughts. But that isn't really good enough, is it? Because posting that image with that caption in that context on a day in which a very traditionally right-wing newspaper, the Daily Mail, posted the most amazing photographic shot of the multiracial new royal family, he must have understood at some level and overridden that, which sort of does make it racist.
And then he said, immediately afterwards, he said, it's not racist and I don't have a diseased mind. Mm. That was the first reaction. So anybody who says it's racist has a diseased mind.
However, just to play devil's advocate, is it helpful to any politics, race politics, identity politics, to do what you've alluded to, Rowan, which is to demonise the transgressor rather than to come up with other strategies and tactics? How do you be angry and be a victim and yet not alienate the aggressor? Is that too big a moral ask?
Yes, it is. It's too big a moral ask. And it shouldn't be asked of Black, Asian, Jewish people ever, because I think there are lines, to use Mrs. May's favourite words, there are red lines. There are some people with whom you can have a conversation, and I have them. But there are some people I would never waste my life trying to explain to Danny Baker why he was wrong. He's a powerful, rich, famous man. If he hasn't educated himself, it's not my problem.
And yet at the same time, Yasmin, you had a piece in The Independent where you're saying that you don't want to have a definition of Islamophobia, that you don't want to create, what, a definition of particular groups? And you know, how do you square that with what you're saying here?
Well, no, there's no contradiction. I think broad alliances of all kinds between people who understand that racism and prejudice and discrimination is wrong, and that those people can be prejudiced themselves, as I've said. And this modern phenomena of singular tribes all kind of competing with each other, kind of becoming competitions of oppression. And that doesn't help us at all. The reason I don't accept the anti-Semitism or the Islamophobia definitions, although a lot of my friends support it, is because we are weak. We who want to fight against racism and make a better society are weak today because we've retribalized and we care only about our own circles. Once upon a time, an anti-racist alliance, I'm old enough to tell you this, included every group, white people included. We just had something to fight together against. And I hate it that some groups, and there's been this, oh, we'll fight for Muslims. Why are you only fighting for Muslims? And anyway, if you're fighting for Muslims, why aren't you talking about our homophobia?
But can't you do both? Can't you have a definition of Islamophobia which you apply?
I think we need to expand our minds and our hearts and work with other people.
But I'm perplexed by how you have, yes, there is a definition of racism, which I think you are saying. You do have a definition.
Racism doesn't have a definition. It is a very broad.
So is it one of those things, you know it when you see it?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And it's to do with colour, ethnicity, religion, language, all sorts of things.
Rowan's smiling almost indulgently. What's going through your mind now, Rowan?
Well, what you just said, racism is you know it when you see it. Actually, it's more like you know it when you experience it. Uh-huh. I mean, that's the unfortunate truth.
I've only experienced anti-Semitism directly and explicitly once in my life, and I've never forgotten that moment. I can conjure up the prickle of coldness that crept all over me. It was in the company of footballers and celebrity footballers and their entourage. Don't ask me why, it's a long story. They were middle-aged men, I was a woman in my early 20s, and one of them turned very slowly, very calmly to another and made a joke about Barbara Streisand to him about me. And it was like a slow motion moment when I realised he was being anti-Semitic and saying, here's this Jewish girl who looks like Barbara Streisand. And I've never forgotten that moment. And that was, I remember thinking, this is that moment when you experience it and you do never forget it. I'm lucky. I'm nearly 55. I've only experienced that moment once.
Like I say, I want to get on the just on the Islamophobia versus racism thing. Does then the definition of Islamophobia become something where, if you're Muslim, then you say, "I know it because I experience it."
But it's racism. Why do we even? I never use the word Islamophobia.
I mean, it's true because actually, somebody listening to this might go, "Big deal," referred to as Barbara Streisand, but it was used to be derogatory and to threaten me, really. The whole language of that encounter, for various reasons I won't go into, was designed like that. And that's difficult to pin down. Rowan, you're a wordsmith. What you do when you perform is very carefully choose your words. So how can words be used forcefully to counteract that kind of hatred?
The first way, and it is a way that the internet has enabled us to do things, is to talk about things. Because that moment you were talking about with your encounter with the Barbara Streisand joke, for me, I obviously no one's accused me of being Barbara Streisand, but I would imagine what you were going through was a sense of isolation, right?
Yes.
You were in a group where you thought you were a part of that group, and I think this is a common experience when you experience these things. It's all right, I know where I am, there's all these people, and then suddenly something happens. I'm on my own, I'm alone. Right, and you're isolated from this group that you thought that I fitted into, that I was accepted into. And that's when it really kind of hurts, I think. And I think what the internet does is enables you to share those moments and find out, actually, it's not just me. I mean, actually, that incident you were talking about, I'll tell you one that I can remember distinctly, because these things do stay with us distinctly. It could have happened 40 or 50 years ago, and you start talking about it. You were straight back there, weren't you, when you were talking about it? You were back in that moment and you felt some of that pain and also probably, I don't know, a sense of shame or something, because which is inexplicable, but is a part of it. But I remember watching as a kid, was it The Good Life on TV, which, you know, I thought was great. And it was like a comedy series, sitcom, very mainstream, BBC One, you know, all the family sitting down watching it. So it was about a family who had decided to opt out of the rat race and set their house up in their garden into a little farm. And next to them was their very straight-laced neighbours, right? In this particular episode, the house next to the straight-laced neighbours was up for sale, and they were terrified that who was going to move into was someone else who was going to set up another farm. So the whole episode went through all that. It came to the end of the thing, the new neighbours moved in, and the punchline is that the family that moved in were Asian. And I suddenly thought, oh my God, and here was me sitting there with my family watching this thing. This is just, you know, fun. And suddenly you think, no, I'm not part of this world. And I think that's what those moments do to you. They isolate you, and the internet can combat that to say you're not alone.
But Charles, you might have experienced bullying or victimisation, even though you look pretty much like a white man to me that doesn't have an experience of anti-Semitism or racism to your history, but you might have experienced being bullied, being isolated. Do you recognise any of what we've been saying?
I've been trying to sort of conjure up memories and I don't have any that are sort of particularly strong, but I think I'm actually quite good at suppressing these things. I'm not a...
We'll have to do another program on that, on suppression and human emotion.
But this is so well put, that it is this feeling of, I thought I belonged to these people. So I was spat at on a bus, number 9 bus on High Street, Ken, in November 2016. This woman didn't know who I was. Quite a nicely dressed woman. And she said, F off, Paki. We don't want you here. And nobody said anything on the bus. So that feeling of isolation.
Awful.
And that was a wake-up moment, because, you know, you think, oh, things are really bad again. Mm-hmm. Things had got better.
That's a post-Brexit effect.
And the second interesting thing is my husband's English. And it was when we had our daughter, and she's got my skin colour, and she had her first experiences of racial bullying, that my husband, who's done a lot of work on race discrimination, actually was an expert on it, he said, it's only now I feel it. Mm-hmm. I knew how to think about it. It's happening to my child, I now feel it. And it's that experience, I think, that I wish more white people would think about, that it's the emotion that never leaves you.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very good note to end on. Even though you are not in this room with us, I hope you are feeling what we are feeling, which is you can't talk about something that matters unless you feel it.
So let's go back to Julia's interview with Professor Charlton McIlwain at the New York University, who talked her through why he wrote this new book, Black Software, the Internet and Racial Justice, From the Afronet to Black Lives Matter.
My work started about 7 or 8 years ago, particularly looking at the digital media arena and technology. And when I arrived, I basically looked out for the other folks who were doing this kind of work.
Couldn't find any.
And I couldn't find very many. And those I could find were folks who were doing this work very early on and had drifted away, and simply not the kind of groundswell that I thought would be there. And what I was looking for, I could see very easily when I looked at the tech landscape or looked at the internet landscape, particularly around issues of race, that clearly people do racist things on the internet. Clearly people traffic in that kind of value system and so forth online. But the question I was interested in was something more like, is the internet racist? And if so, how do we make that kind of determination? What do we look at? How do we sort of have some kind of criteria to define it? And so those were the questions that motivated me when I first started to look in this area. And it was questions that I saw no one really addressing or answering in that way.
And presumably alongside that, you know, $64,000 question, which I want to come back to, is the internet racist, is also, what about the democratizing, equalizing, giving voice power of the internet? So give me the bad news first. Is the internet racist?
The bad news is yes, right. As you might expect.
And what's that about? Is that because people are racist, so the internet is racist? Or is that the internet is giving a different kind of behavior?
In part, it's the connection to people, but really it's a connection to a long-standing set of values and history around technology around the world, but particularly in the United States. And what I really mean by that is that when we look at the precursor technologies on which the internet was built, that those tools around computing and so forth in the early 60s were developed around a value and goal of suppressing civil rights, particularly civil rights for African Americans. And so it's interesting to me to have found out that ultimately these systems of computing in whatever iteration we find them from the 1960s up to the present were built explicitly to discriminate and to uphold simply a system of white supremacy. Very clearly. And so when I say the internet is racist, in part what I'm saying is it is part of the same systemic values that motivated them from the very beginning.
That is almost incredible. What do you mean by that, that structurally the computational design? Talk us through
Sure. What
that means.
Yeah, what that means is that when we look at the 1960s, computing is starting to reach a new era in that it is developing, it is growing, it is proliferating in businesses and governments and private enterprise, and a little while later, individually, into people's homes. We had been familiar with computers and computational power in the context of war. And in the 1960s, at some point, as computing began to develop, of course, those that were building computers were saying, all right, who will use these? Who will buy these tools? What benefit can we sort of share about them? And on the other end, you had government already used to deploying these tools that came with a very specific problem. And that problem was, we've got black people rioting in the streets, talking about their civil rights and doing so in ways that seem outside of our comfort zone. That means they are working with governments, but when things go wrong, they're out in the streets and they're looting and they're setting fires and all these things. And so the connection of blackness and African Americans to crime very early on set the government to say, look, what do we do? What must we do? What can we do to help solve this problem? And the answer became, why don't we look to these computers that have worked so well for us overseas in fighting wars and staving off foreign enemies? And so the use of computing from that very early time was used specifically to help ameliorate a particular and present threat that was about race, that was about African Americans, and about the advancement of the civil rights agenda.
This is, of course, something that usually bypasses most users of the internet and computers. But when it comes to today, to the middle of the teenage years of the 21st century, what is happening around black protests like Black Lives Matter? Is the internet more the friend of protests now? Is there an upside?
There is an upside, but with an equally and maybe even more compelling downside, at least from my point of view, and that is this sort of democratizing promise of the internet that has come into being in, you know, more recent years, certainly with the dawn of the web in the early 90s and then up to its current iteration, really does hold out some promises and ability for folks to mobilize and use its tools for liberatory purposes, to fight back against the powers that be, racially speaking, gender speaking, so on and so forth. And that's very, very true, and that's what Black Lives Matter really revealed, that folks that had a very sophisticated understanding of social life, of organizing, mobilizing people for the advancement of racial equality, racial equity, could use those tools to do something that really folks have not done in decades, which is raise the profile of race, of racial discrimination, of racial violence on top of the certainly the U.S. agenda, if not the world stage, which is a place it had not occupied since the late 60s, early 70s. And so in that way, it's become positive through social media, through many other platforms and other forms of digital media, to be able to fight and highlight and really draw attention to these causes. But at the same time, and what we learned sort of very clearly and early on with the Black Lives Matter movement is, as soon as some innovation that allows the group to organize and mobilize outside of the confines of the policing system, you find eventually the state and police catch up. And so seeing the widespread surveillance of social media, the widespread condemnation of Black Lives Matter activists as enemies of the state, and set as a focal point for law enforcement, both nationally and locally, shows, I think, that downside, which is, again, going back to the sort of first purposes for which this technology was built. That is, it will give us an upside. And eventually, you find people who are connected and able to use it to do many, many different things and have many possible things to do. But at bottom, this is a tool for the state, driven by both state and private enterprise, and can always be changed, shifted, and flexed for those purposes, even as people try to use them for others.
So you're saying that digital media is disadvantaged by being effectively at a disadvantage from the get-go?
It is. That is the way we have come to know, understand, and use these technologies. And so, you know, as much as I might walk out onto the street and find people across the city that are able and willing and even have a predilection to mobilize these tools for good, for the advancement of racial justice, every day what they fight and what we fight is a government that says, look, I want to recognize people's faces across New York City, and I want to do so easily using artificial intelligence so that I can monitor and surveil their every behavior. And when you have a government that says, look, I'm willing to pay millions and millions of dollars in order to have this happen and come to be, it's quite hard for private enterprise to say, no, I'm not going to take that contract. No, I don't really think this should be used for those purposes. Those purposes are the driving engine for these types of technologies.
Thank you again to our studio guests, Yasmin Alibi-Brown and Rowan Kandapa. You've been listening to The Human and Machine with me, Julia Hobsbawm, and with Charles Arthur. It's an Auditorial Intelligence production for Editorial Intelligence. Please subscribe to us on the Apple Podcasts. Studio production has been done by Guy here at Spiritland and by George McDonough, our editor. Thank you for listening.